Individual psalms like Psalm 23 have been cherished by Jews and Christians alike throughout history and have pervaded Western culture deeply. But when it comes to the Psalter as a whole, few people know what to do with it. Is there any logic to its arrangement? Who put these psalms together and why? Since the 1980s, scholars have endeavored to demonstrate the value of a holistic approach to the Psalter, some even suggesting that a plot line runs through its five books. Here to challenge that trend is David Wilgren. In a moment, we'll be discussing his recent book, The Formation of the Book of Psalms, published by Moore Seebeck in 2016. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, and I'm Michael Morales, your host. David Wilgren received a Ph.D. in Old Testament exegesis from Lund University in 2016 and is currently lecturer in Norwegian School of Leadership and Theology. In addition to The Formation of the Book of Psalms, he is co-editor and contributor to the book Studies in Isaiah, History, Theology, and Reception, published by Bloomsbury T&T Clark in 2017. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be on.
Well, David, in some challenging ways, your work goes against current trends in the study of the Psalms. Why don't we begin with that context first? Increasingly, since the work of Gerald Wilson, scholars have set forth readings of the Psalter that aim to display its logical flow. Some even argue for a linear movement throughout the five books. Could you fill in that picture for us?
Yeah, that's a good place to start, I think. Maybe I could go back even further just to sketch the picture of the state of the field prior to Wilson. Go back perhaps even to the famous scholar Hermann Gunkel. He's perhaps most famous for his work on forms, the Gattungs of the Psalms. But he actually devoted some part of his scholarly work to the organization of the Psalms into a collection. And reading that chapter, you quickly get a sense of his basic argument that content or Gattung form played quite a little role in the organization of the Psalms. There was no overarching principle, but rather he saw the Psalms collections as a quite random collection consisting of compilation of possibly previously independent collections and so on. But his main focus was on the last addition made, and that in his view was Psalms 3-41, which he concluded was a kind of a prayer book, and that made him draw the conclusion that the entire book of Psalms, once this collection was added, came to have a primarily post-Celtic and private setting. So that became kind of the standard view to view these Psalms as kind of post-Celtic, and even his student Movinkel, the Norwegian scholar famous for the enthronement festival, agreed with him in this sense when looking at the final form of the Book of Psalms. And he actually pointed to Psalm 1 as a kind of motto that shed further light on the aim and use of the collection, namely as a book of pious meditation related to the ways of the righteous and the wicked. But starting with Westermann and Childs, this began to change a bit. I mean, Westermann noted that content seemed to play some kind of function, especially in royal psalms and hymns, which, according to Westermann, were clustered in a certain way that seemed intentional, although he did not unwrap this kind of redactional intention any further. And Childs proceeded with his kind of canonical approach and linked the function of Psalm 1 to what he described as a transformation of the words, the prayers of the people of God to God, which were then transformed into God's words to his people. So together with Psalm 2, the juxtaposed psalm there in the beginning of the Book of Psalms, a royal psalm, they introduced the theme of the Book of Psalms, which was then considered some kind of eschatological collection. So that was mainly the background. We had this idea of kind of a random collection, but small steps were taken into seeing that there might have been some redactional activity kind of bringing this collection together and perhaps even indicated some ways in which this collection was to be used. And the strength of Wilson, who published his dissertation, The Editing of the Hebrew Psalter, in 1985, was that he attempted to situate this discussion in kind of a broader ancient Near Eastern context. So he started off by looking at Sumerian temple hymns and Babylonian and Assyrian incipit catalogs and detected various ways in which these poetic compositions could be juxtaposed. Then you turn to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and especially the Psalm Scrolls, which were being published and made known to the to a larger scholarly knowledge. And he detected similar techniques there. So that gave him a great arsenal of tools to employ to his primary material, the Masoretic sequence of Psalms that we often imply when we say the Book of Psalms. And his main focus was on the superscriptions, you know, these kind of first lines in many of the Psalms that attribute the Psalm to a certain figure or speak of perhaps the Psalms genre and so on. And he argued that these kind of features, the author designations, the Le David or Livne Korach and genre designations, Shir Mizmor, had been used and employed intentionally to create structures throughout the Book of Psalms. They demarcated sequences, and often by means of changing the author designation. So when there was a change in an author designation, there was possibility that the redactors wanted to indicate what he called a seam, a significant juncture. And the major seams were around the book divisions, where Wilson noted that a change in these author designations overlapped with a change in genre designations. So, for example, between books 2 and 3, we have a Psalm of Solomon ending book 2 in Psalm 72, and then followed by a Mizmor Asaph in Psalm 73. So that was strong disjunctures.
Mm-hmm.
And then he argued that the genre designations could also be used to soften the transitions. So, for example, Wilson did not consider the sequence of Psalms 47 to 51 to include a seam, despite that we have a shift from three Psalms of Korach to one Asaph and one Davidic Psalm, because all these five Psalms had the same genre designation, the Mizmor. So in this way, he kind of deconstructed the first three books of Psalms as intentionally gathered and highlighted the importance of the Psalms in the seams. And he conceived the other two books, books 4 and 5, quite differently, with different techniques, but the main thrust of his thesis was the same. It was an intentionally organized book with the themes were significant in developing the overarching theology in this kind of book. So by looking at these psalms which were placed in the themes, he reconstructed two frameworks that were intended to guide the reading of the individual psalms. A royal covenantal framework with these royal psalms and a sapiential framework with these wisdom psalms. And they suggested a way of reading or meditating, a careful study, and the content, which was his basic main conclusion, that the purpose of the Book of Psalms was to direct the faithful away from trust in human failing princes and rather trust in Adonai as king. So the book, in its final form and through this kind of redaction, spoke a clear final message. And what this kind of research essentially did was to open up a new era of research, the literary context of individual psalms, placing weight on where it was placed in this kind of book collection. And as we all know, many studies followed, and many strands of at least American research are indebted to Wilson, although they all take various parts. And if you would pick up a study or introduction to the Book of Psalms, you could come across some kind of plot or storyline which are said to develop throughout these themes, so that books 1 and 2 reflect the founding era of Kings David and Solomon, for example. We have a lot of psalms attributed to David, and Psalm 72 ends with like David's prayers to Solomon. And then book 3 depicts the decline until the Babylonian exile, which has its cry in Psalm 89. And then book 4 focuses on exile to the expectations of homecoming with Psalm 106, phrasing that or formulating that kind of prayer to bring back the dispersed people. And then book 5 concentrates on the reestablishment of Israel. So we have this kind of overarching plot that follows the history of Israel throughout the Book of Psalms. So that was mainly the contribution of Wilson, and that's basically the story, but it's perhaps not the whole story, because we have also the German scholarship which moved in a similar direction, but from a slightly different perspective, not quite directly influenced by Wilson. And here perhaps Hassfeld and Zenger are the best representatives. And rather than looking at overarching frameworks and themes, they look at connection between juxtaposed psalms, lexical, semantical motifs, or thematical, and so on, and try to reconstruct earlier collection which is with its own theological stress and brought together then redacted together in light of some overarching idea. And they found the purpose of the entire collection in the last edition, as Gunkel did. But this was Psalms 145 to 150, rather. And their idea is that the Book of Psalms had been transformed into a kind of temple of words, which was, of course, post-cultic and non-liturgical, with Psalms 1 and 2 as a joint introduction. So you could, in a way, say that despite these kind of methodological differences in American and German scholarship, there's a basic broad consensus on the aspects of the effects on juxtaposing psalms and an agreement that the final shape kind of speaks a message intended by redactors. So that's basically how I would characterize the state of the field that I kind of enter into when I formulate my dissertation.
I can think of a number of dissertations just within the last 5 years, some of them concentrating on book four of the Psalms and developing the theme and getting deeper into that sort of analysis. But in your book, you attempt to show that such holistic, canonical, or linear readings of the Psalter actually have some weaknesses in method. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Yeah, I actually, when I started out writing my dissertation, I was intended to work within the perspective or methodological framework established by Wilson. I was convinced that the themes were important in understanding the theology of the Book of Psalms and so on. But as I started to read into it more deeply, and I started to realize, to myself at least, to convince myself that there were some of the presuppositions of this kind of research that did not hold up to closer scrutiny. For example, what does it tell something? What kind of apply? How was it read? I tried to look at some collections in the ancient Near East, and it struck me that the idea of a book that was intended to be read in some kind of lecture continua was kind of anachronistic, especially when I looked closer at the Dead Sea Scrolls and saw the variation in the way psalms could be juxtaposed there. So I tried to not, in a way, give up on the notion of the book, but try to define it in relation to the material with the help of the concept of anthology, and maybe we can come back to that later. But when I studied the comparative material and the use of psalms throughout the Second Temple period, I did not see that kind of presupposition hold up. So that was the first part. And the second part was that I thought there was sometime a lacking... scholars lacked a distinction between various unifying patterns. Were they reading synchronically, trying to look at this kind of heterogeneous collection as a composition, or were they looking at redactional features diachronically to see how these collections might have looked prior to their edition, or was it a canonical argument? So I argue in my book that there's often a conflation of synchronic observations and diachronic reconstructions. And a way to frame that discussion and to assess the various functions ascribed to features of Psalms, I introduced the notion of paratextuality, which was coined by a French literary scholar, Gérard Genette, in his book Paratext, Thresholds of Interpretations. And paratexts are basically a way for me to put a word on and theorize around what scholars are essentially claiming as functions for these kinds of psalms. When Genette defines paratext, he refers to elements that surround the text, extend the text to present it. They are not part of the text themselves, but basic features like superscriptions, like prefaces, like epilogues, and so on. But the third one that I had a problem with was the often recurring linear construction. and the Masoretic primacy in many of these cases, especially when you study the Book 4, for example, as you mentioned. All of these kind of study suppose that we can inquire into editorial intent by studying a specific sequence of psalms that we know as the Masoretic one. But when we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, that could not be taken for granted. You have to argue that. You want me to? I could take two examples just to exemplify this further if you want me to.
Yes, that would be helpful.
I mean, I mentioned Wilson's use of author designations. So, for example, he presupposes that there was a fixed order of psalms which was arranged by author designations, and then that type or genre designations were added to smoothen over or enforce these kind of junctures. But actually, he doesn't claim that there was a fixed order, but he claims that psalms with similar type designations or genre designations were brought together to this effect, which was would then indicate that the premises for his argument would fail, because there would be no fixed order and then no problem with the author junctures, because there wouldn't haven't been any strong junctures, and it would have been easy just to remove or rearrange these kind of author designated psalms. And there was also a problem with the doxologies, because many of his themes occurred, in his view, throughout the book divisions of the Book of Psalms. So in his argument, it would seem that they were in place prior to the adding of the genre designations. But the actual material that we have suggests the other way around. That is that the genre and type designations were actually in place at least prior to the Davidic superscriptions, and possibly also prior to the doxologies added to the books. And we can see that quite clearly when we compare the Masoretic text to the Septuagint, for example, which has a lot of psalms with Davidic superscriptions that are not attributed to David in the Masoretic sequence. So we see the way these kind of superscriptions are added in this other material. And interestingly, we have scrolls in the Judean desert that actually show us this kind of Davidization process, adding of superscriptions, give us a snapshot. If we look at, for example, a scroll, an old scroll named 4Q83, which is from the 2nd century BCE, we have Psalm 33 there without a Davidic superscriptions. And then when we go later to 4Q98, in the late 1st century or early 1st century CE, we have it with a Davidic superscriptions. And we have a similar case in Psalm 104, which is found in two scrolls, in 486 and 487. So we have this kind of clear picture of Psalms increasingly gaining this author designations, which would undercut the theory of Wilson that these would have been quite fixed and needed to be smoothened over or enforced by genre designation. And the other example is related to the work of Zenger and Hossfeld, which focused much more on lexical links. Because there we have the idea that we have a lot of overlaps between vocabulary in two psalms, and if that kind of overlap also corresponded to thematic similarities, we could argue that they were intentionally juxtaposed. So a way of inquiring into this, I looked at the way Psalm 147 was found in different collections, because that is a psalm which we have in two different collections, in the Qumran material and in the Masoretic collection, and also in the Septuagint. And what is interesting is that in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have this psalm juxtaposed to other psalms, which are also Masoretic psalms, Psalms 104, 105, and 106. So we know the vocabulary of these psalms, we can reconstruct it, and then we can compare the amount of lexical links. So I looked at first the Masoretic text, and I concluded that, well, if we count the amount of lexical links, that will be 31. And then I looked at the scroll 4Q86 and counted the possible lexical links in a similar way, and concluded, well, there we have a significant increase of lexical links. We have 48 lexical links. And the same number was found in the 11Q5. And interestingly, there was also thematic overlaps between these psalms that could strengthen this image further. So my question was basically, if we have this kind of increase in lexical links, should we also say that, well, this indicates that these songs were composed to their current position in these scrolls, as it is often argued when you find these kind of connections in the Masoretic sequence? And my answer is no. Well, I think rather the method and the approach is faulty. You have to approach these issues in some other way, rather than counting overlaps between songs, because in the end, psalmody is quite repeated language, and we found that kind of language popping up in all kinds of places in the Hebrew Bible and the Second Temple literature. So basically, that to me led to a more fundamental critique of the work of Wilson and others that promoted kind of unified reading of the Book of Psalms. And I make several of these kinds of observations in my study.
Now, as part of your argument that scholars have been depending too much on the Masoretic text?
Yeah, I think so. And the way the reason I can say that is because when we look at the earliest attested scrolls with Psalms, the situation is quite different. In the Dead Sea, in Qumran, we have found, I think the most recent number is 45 scrolls that in some way include Psalms. And the reason I say in some way is because we shouldn't draw the conclusions that all these kind of scrolls are copies of a book of Psalms. We have fragments that could include small fragments of words to longer scrolls. And the longest is this 5 meter long 11Q5, the 11Q Psalms A scroll, which has Psalms from book 4 and 5 in kind of a different order than we have it in the Masoretic text, and also in mixed with Psalms that are not part of the Masoretic collection. So we have this kind of heterogeneous collections that do not necessarily resemble in all cases the Masoretic sequence. And since that is the earliest material we have to at least consider that kind of material when we reconstruct parts of the Book of Psalms and say that this is reflecting editorial intent in the way these are juxtaposed. The way I frame it in my book is that I try to look at how Psalms seems to be juxtaposed, how sequences seems to be formed in these scrolls. And I conclude that there are several sequences which overlap quite significantly with the Masoretic text. So there would have been some kind of tradition of juxtaposing Psalms in this time, but that does not warrant the conclusion that there was a redactional intent to promote a certain reading of these Psalms that would be linear. So that's the main point of my critique, I would say.
Now, do you see your own research as overturning then the work of Wilson and others, or merely nuancing it?
Well, I for the first, I try to pay my homage to Wilson and his legacy by in the way I also structure my book. I structure it similarly in a way to Wilson. So I think that he made vital and significant contributions to the field. But as I frame my argument, I would say it is kind of a thoroughgoing critique of his perspective in a way, questioning the way that he reconstructed the formation and also primarily the answer to why these Psalms were gathered into a collection. So I think we have a lot of points where we would disagree if we would had the possibility to meet at some point.
Well, getting back to some of those questions, so for your doctoral dissertation, the fruit of it is this Mor Sebek book, The Formation of the Book of Psalms. You tackle two big fundamental questions. First, how was the Book of Psalms formed and why? Lead us through your findings on that first question. How was the Psalter formed?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. And I mean, my study is perhaps too bold to be a dissertation, because I try to join kind of material from kind of a broad area of study into my argument. And the issue that I had to address when asking this question of how was the Psalter formed was first, well, which tools are possible to use when reconstructing the formation? Because I had discarded the superscriptions as indicators of earlier collections, because we see this increasing Davidization, so we can't use that to trace back collections, at least not the Davidic ones. And I also argued that the doxologies were quite late, at least the doxologies added to Psalms 89 and 41. So I had to look partially at quotes of Psalms in other literature to see, well, which Psalms seems to have been known at what periods of time. But then I remember, I mean, sometimes when we do scholarly work, we have these kind of epiphanies is perhaps the wrong word, but we have these breakthrough moments when we realize we reach some conclusion that we hadn't thought about before. And I remember I was reading this quite odd verse in Psalm 72:20, Kalu Tefilot David Ben Yishai. Here ends the prayers of David's son of Yishai. And of course, that has been kind of an enigma for scholars throughout time, because it's obvious that the Psalms of David does not end in the Masoretic sequence after Psalm 72, because there are other Psalms of David, and we have all these kind of issues. I mean, Psalm 72 is not a Psalm of David; it's a Psalm of Solomon. What kind of collection did it end, and so on? But I was reading through some work on scribal practices, and I stumbled into some scribal colophons, and then I started to observe that there were some similarities between how Psalm 72:20 looked and how these kind of other colophons from the surrounding scribal cultures looked. And then I realized, well, this might just have been an old colophon, and the basic function of that would have been then to the colophon was a scribal activity where they wrote down something that related to the contents of a scroll. Well, to whom did this belong? From what copy was this copied? And what does it contain? And so on. So my idea was that Psalm 72:20 would have originally concluded or filled such functions in relation to a scroll filled with psalm scrolls. And when I looked at similar colophons, I also noted that these kinds of expressions like Kalu, they seem to feature in scrolls that were part of series of scrolls. So to me, that indicated that such a colophon would have been added when a collection of psalms were large enough to fill up more than one scroll, possibly two scrolls. And so I tried to situate that into a discussion of how many scrolls would be needed to keep all these psalms that we have now in the Masoretic sequence. And so that became my starting point. Okay, now we have some kind of collection that is quite large, that is concluded or that has this colophon that has in some way become frozen to the psalm. And I had a parallel to that kind of freezing activity in the Sumerian temple hymns. But that led me to suggest that, well, some point in history, we would have had this kind of larger collection that eventually would not need to be rearranged in any significant way, but could have been quite stable in general, but not in regard to every single psalm that was included in it. So Psalm 72:20 became my starting point, and I suggested that the two scrolls that this psalm could, this verse, so this colophon could be added to, could possibly have contained Psalms 1 and 119. So I try, when I discuss how the Psalter was formed, or how the Book of Psalms was formed, I try to sketch three main stages rather than trying to reconstruct details in how these psalms could be juxtaposed, because that would be counter to my argument of the possibility of reconstructing linear development. So then I looked at the phrase tefila, prayers of David, and I found some curious passages in Isaiah 56 and 2 Chronicles 6:40, which spoke of psalmody with this term. I mean, in 2 Chronicles 6:40, we have an introduction of a quote from 32 with Tefi. also the position of these Torah Psalms, Psalmody with Torah and the Levites and all, seems to be connected to that. That was my first stage where we could see a Psalms collection growing or taking shape in the post-exilic times. And the next step was that I saw that, well, we have increasing citations of Psalms. For example, we have the presence of a Psalm in another Psalm in Psalm 135, which quotes extensively from Psalm 115, for example. We have this Levitical medley almost in First Chronicles 16, where we have three Psalms also known from the Masoretic Book of Psalms, Psalms 96, 105, and 106, which seems to be quoted and presupposed some kind of collection of Psalms, perhaps. And then we have this Levitical phrase, Hodu Adonai Kitov, which reoccurred at many places in Chronicles and in also in the latter parts of the Masoretic Book of Psalms. We have these kind of connections between them. So I suggested that the second stage was actually connected to those Psalms, would have included those Psalms. And I suggest that the fivefold division, these doxologies, these Baruch doxologies, would have been added at this point. So we have this fivefold division of a collection that linked it even more closely to the way the Pentateuch was divided. And then the last stage would have been a stage where Hallelujah frameworks were added. And that eventually would have turned the entire collection into what we now know as the Sefer Tehillim, which changed the way it was referred to. And I'm only speaking generally about my conclusions. I'm not presenting the arguments in detail, of course, but I found traces of such a formative stage, for example, in the way Psalm 145 seems to relate the Barach terminology to the Halal terminology and so on. So the how question is quite generally answered in three major stages, which to my mind explains these kind of most explicit features of the paratextual features of the Book of Psalms, the colophon, the fivefold division, and then the Hallelujah frameworks. So that was my main argument, I would say.
That is interesting. Thank you. Well, let's go to your second question. Why were the Psalms formed into a canon?
Yeah, and actually, when you frame the question that way, you in a way anticipate my answer, because the word canon, The way I ask the question in the book is why were the Psalms formed into a book? And I suggest that the canon could be an interesting concept to include in the way I frame the answer.
Okay.
Because in a way, when I look at the comparative material, for example, I look at some other kinds of similar collections of poetry and psalmody in other cultures. And especially when I look at the way it's done in Mesopotamian cultures, we see this kind of, over time, a canonization of poetry or literature that seems to have a great impact. And that would be the main way I would frame the answer to the question why, is to use the term canon. It seems to me that over time, it seemed clear that some of the Psalms that were used, I think the Dead Sea Scrolls show clearly that there was a vast literature which included Psalms of various kinds throughout the entire transmission period of the Book of Psalms. But some of these Psalms eventually were seen perhaps as durable language to express faith in the various communities of faith that use these Psalms in their interaction with God. And so these Psalms were revered and used in these communities, and also in the long run would be given an authoritative status in the community. So I would say that the Book of Psalms was not primarily a literary whole, but rather to be seen as a central container of authoritative psalmody, demarcating it from the rest of the possible psalms that were also used. So I tried to make a distinction between selection and organization, and that to me is quite crucial in the way we argue in relation to the shape of the Book of Psalms, because I think there were intentionality in the selection, in the way psalms were selected, but perhaps not in the same way in the way they were juxtaposed, arranged, organized. And I use a scholar named Anne Ferry, who says that it could be seen as a physical embodiment and figurative representation of the tradition, these kind of collections. So in my mind, it's kind of a creative dynamic preservation of a quite complex collection. And if related to my discussion of paratext, I conclude that they do not perform the quite long-going unifying functions that most scholars today would ascribe to them. An example, of course, is Psalm 1, which is almost unanimously viewed as a preface to the Book of Psalms. And when I look at the psalm, I mean, the main reason why it's argued to be a preface is the first three verses, where we have this focus on Torah and meditating on the Torah. And Torah is often interpreted as in line with its basic meaning of instruction, and including the Book of Psalms into that kind of instruction, so that the Psalms are referred to in Psalm 1. So that when Psalm 1 speaks about meditating on Torah, it is essentially meditating on the Book of Psalms, a kind of reading instruction.
Right.
And to my mind, the way that Torah is used in that psalm, because we have the expression Torat Adonai, and that expression is almost only found in kind of late literature. We have that in the Psalms. We have that in Psalm 1, Psalm 119, and Psalm 19, and we have it quite a lot in Chronicles. And the reference seems almost exclusively be the Torah of Moses, or a Torah of Moses. So to my mind, that would be the most natural reference also in Psalm 1. So we would have a preface in that way that did not point to the actual collection of Psalms, but pointed the reader into a completely other direction. So that would be quite unusual for a preface. And then I look at the way this psalm was received, and I see that, well, for the first period of its transmission, if we look at the way it was used in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have a pesher on that includes a quote of Psalm 1 and Psalm 2, and also a lot of other psalms. We have no indication of a prefatorial use, and actually this kind of prefatorial use seems to pop up in the 3rd century, where we also have a kind of development in the book history where these kinds of functions were expected to be found in these collections. So I would say that Psalm 1 could be read as a preface, but that essentially belongs to reception history of the Book of Psalms rather than editorial intent, for example. So I draw these kinds of conclusions in relation to many of the paratexts, and I have a long chapter on Psalm 1. And I found quite a little support for the current widespread idea that the Psalms were intended to be read as in the context of the Book of Psalms, in the literary context, apart from the idea that the book would be a container in this case. And I looked, as I said, at the Qumran Pesharim to see what kind of interpretive context is presupposed in the way Psalms are used there and so on, and suggest that the main effect of this paratexting or adding of paratext was the Davidization of psalmody rather than creating a kind of literary context for psalms.
That is interesting. I want to talk a little bit now about what factor, what role a final editing plays in our interpretation, by just getting on a very practical level. So let's say there's a pastor who's going to be preaching a series through the Psalms. Are you saying that there really is no real exegetical value to a particular psalm's placement in the Psalter, whether that psalm happens to be in Book 2 or Book 4, that basically each psalm should simply be treated in isolation?
Well, that's an excellent question, because I think many of those who interpret Psalms and use introduction to Psalms are using them in the context you're actually referring to. But I would say that that depends on the focus. What is the preacher or the scholar interested in? Are we asking historical questions, or are we trying to try to be theologically constructive? Because I can say, I held a paper in this year's SBL annual meeting, and I concluded my paper there on Psalms 1 and 2, why they are not to be considered the preface, with the two following questions. So, do I believe that Psalm 1 could be read as a preface to the Book of Psalms? Yes. So I answer that question affirmatively. But then I ask, do I believe that it originally functioned in such a way? And I say no. So my thesis is mainly trying to reconstruct and answer the way we can, what we can know about how the Book of Psalms came to be, and what we can say about possible reasons why they were gathered. And a metaphor I use at the end of my book is trying to, maybe a too simple metaphor, but I refer to modern day cookbooks, where we have this gathering of recipes, and we can have headings or superscriptions that say, well, these kind of recipes which are in this section are supposed to be main dishes or whatever. And we can also look at the recipes, and we can see many overlaps in the ingredients and so on, but no one would go from there, from the noted overlaps and the paratextual linking of these recipes, and conclude that, well, we should mix all these recipes into one single dish and serve it. And that's mainly also what I'm trying to argue in relation to the Book of Psalms, that we have all these psalms that are individual compositions. They are brought together, and there might be some reasons for some sequences why they are juxtaposed, but that does not warrant us to read them as a single composition. But if returning to your question about the poster preaching, I mean, there could be cases where you want to experiment and try to, if we keep the metaphor, mix some ingredients from various dishes and try to create something new. So I wouldn't say that my thesis renders all these kinds of expository preachings on Psalms unnecessary or problematic. But if you enter into the role as a scholar and try to answer historical questions on how these Psalms were formed, I think that would be another matter entirely. I could take another example. For example, scholars often speak of collections in the Book of Psalms, but it's not often made the distinction, or it's not always clear whether they are talking about demarcated sequences in the Masoretic collection or something similar, that is a synchronic statement, or as previously independent collections, that is the diachronic statements. And to me, those are quite different proposals. And I mean, the way this Book of Psalms is gathered into a collection, I would say it's entirely possible to read the Book of Psalms as I referred to in the beginning of our talk. I mean, these kind of historical growing of a story from Book 1 to Book 5. But I have problems when we claim that would have been an intentional gathering or arrangement of the Psalms. I don't know if that makes anything clear.
Yes, that makes sense. Well, before we let you go, David, can you tell us about any other projects you're working on?
Yeah, actually, now I just finished this thesis in spring. It got published now after the summer, and this fall I've been doing a lot of teaching. And I look forward now to the spring, where I'll be finishing some articles, which are kind of spin-off articles from my dissertation. But I'm also now currently applying for some funding, research funding, that's the way it works in Sweden. You have to apply for money for new projects. And I will love to continue my focus on the way insights from book history and material culture can shed light on the way we have interpreted, or perhaps often misinterpreted, features in the text, and especially look at the way the printing press might have affected our understanding of textual stability and compositional coherence, because I have a sense that many of the readings proposed by Wilson and the scholars following him are presupposing a notion of textual stability that we can't really apply uncritically to this ancient context where we don't have books, we have scrolls, and we have various kinds of way of dealing with these kinds of psalms collections and so on. So that would be an area of interest to me, at least.
Sounds like you've got good labors ahead of you. Well, David, it's been great talking to you and hearing more about your book. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today.
Thank you.
All right, friends, you've been listening to David Wilgren discussing his recent book, The Formation of the Book of Psalms. Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Biblical Studies. Until next time, goodbye.